from an equity perspective on the top 10 stocks market cap weighting in global indexes. And as you said, this number, this figure continues to get bigger. In Spain, the top 10 stocks account for nearly 70% of the market cap of the index.
Wow.
The NASDAQ 100, it's 57%. In Germany, it's 62%. In Hong Kong, in the two indexes, the Hang Seng Proper, it's 67, and in the HSCEI, it's 68. In the S&P 100, it's 36%, and the Nikkei is now growing to 27%. The S&P is 23%. So for all intents and purposes, if you have an idea of what these top 10 stocks are doing, you have an idea what the market is doing.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Last week, we played a show that we did earlier called The Concentration of Risk, Part 1. This week's show, we're going to do something fresh and build on that with Concentration of Risk, Part 2. But look at it more from a trading perspective. What could happen when all these stocks and so many financial assets are concentrated in just a handful of key financial players? That's coming up on The Big Picture today.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, it's interesting because at one point we thought that after Dodd-Frank, the system had become safer. We've beefed up reserves. Banks are better capitalized. But the financial system actually changed since the crisis back in 2008. And the big, it seems, got bigger. As we said, continuation of the idea of concentration of risk.
Well, the interesting thing about this, John, is during the financial crisis, the Fed and the government worked with the bigger banks like J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and they basically merged a lot of these entities. At one time, we had five investment banks. We're down basically to two, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. And during the crisis, Bear Stearns, Washington Mutual went to J.P. Morgan, Countrywide, Merrill Lynch went to Bank of America, and Wachovia went to Wells Fargo.
Okay, so today's topic then is, I guess, what does all this really mean? You know, you've got all these mergers going on. How does that translate into something that might affect investments or you and me?
Well, I mean, we covered some of this in A Concentration of Risk, which we played last weekend. And what I want to do is kind of recap some of that. So I want to sort of lay out the framework of how big this has gotten. It's not just that assets have accumulated in fewer and fewer hands and the big got bigger. It's assets in general. I don't care if it's mutual fund companies, if it's banking companies, if it's derivative holders, if it's concentration of stock holdings and particular stocks. All of this has been concentrated since the last financial crisis. And what is astonishing about the financial crisis, it concentrated risk in fewer hands. It's not just that these entities that failed, that were merged into other entities, but these entities themselves got bigger and bigger and bigger. So today, whether you're looking at bank deposits, whether you're looking at derivatives, whether you're looking at the holdings of the largest widely held stocks, they are in the hands of fewer and fewer individuals and institutions. And just to recap from last week, we have five banks now that control over 90% of your deposits. We have five mutual fund families that control the bulk of mutual fund assets. We have five financial institutions that control the bulk of this nation's assets. I'm talking about stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and annuities. And we have five firms that control the majority of ETFs, which are probably the most innovative and probably the most popular form of investing today. Moreover, the concentration does not stop there. The result of the bubble is that in passive fund investing, which is all the rage and fad right now, ownership of stocks is also concentrated in the markets. And you take a look at the most popular held stocks today, the ones that have done very well this year, whether you're talking about Apple, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, all of these stocks are controlled by a handful of companies, the largest owners of mutual funds, the largest owners and purveyors of ETFs. So this very concentration has become even more so this year when you've seen the indexes that are up like the Dow over 20% this year, or you see the NASDAQ up over 20%. It is the concentration of these handful of stocks that is driving these indexes up and concentrating once again the bulk of the value of the index itself in fewer and fewer stocks. This is not a widely dispersed market where all stocks are participating, but not to the same extent that you're seeing concentration in basically a handful of stocks. I mean, if you take a look at all the indexes, it's probably 5, 10, maybe 35 stocks that make up the bulk of holdings, and this is universal. These top 10 stocks, whether it's the FANG stocks, are increasingly making a larger portion of the index. How much is this index being driven higher by these stocks?
Well, I know this may not sit well with a lot of folks, but I sort of have thought about this since 2013, because I continued to look inside the market to determine what was leading. And while the market was up, I think 95% of the stocks in the S&P were up in 2013, and there were more stocks up 50% than were actually down in that year. And I determined that what was leading the market then was the S&P 500, driven by the what I think is the SPY, the spider. And so I endeavored, Jim, from that point forward to concentrate most of my efforts from an equity perspective on the top 10 stocks market cap weighting in global indexes. And as you said, this number, this figure continues to get bigger. In Spain, the top 10 stocks account for nearly 70% of the market cap of the index.
Wow.
The Nasdaq 100, it's 57%. In Germany, it's 62%. In Hong Kong, in the two indexes, the Hang Seng proper, it's 67, and in the HSCEI, it's 68. In the S&P 100, it's 36%, and the Nikkei is now growing to 27%. The S&P is 23%. So for all intents and purposes, if you have an idea of what these top 10 stocks are doing, you have an idea what the market is doing. And I think it's going to become increasingly more relevant, as I believe ETFs drive stocks. Stocks do not drive ETFs.
That was from an interview Jim did with John Roke several weeks ago, indicating the concentration of the major indexes.
And, you know, the thing that John Roke really brought out, you know, we've talked about it here when we did our first show on the bubble back in May of this year. But what John Roke has done in his study is showing that it's not just something that you're seeing here in the NASDAQ, the Dow, or the S&P. This phenomenon is global. And it's this concentration that we've seen and we've talked about in our own S&P, but is actually even bigger when you go to select indexes like the Qs or maybe the S&P 500. Because if you take those top 10 stocks and the NASDAQ 100, they represent 57% of the index, or in the S&P 100, 36%. But the concentration is even larger when you look at Europe and Asia. In, for example, the DAX index, the top 10 stocks are 62% of the index, 67% of the Hang Seng, 70% of the IBEX, 27% of the Nikkei, or 48% of the FTSE. So everywhere you look, within our own markets, within smaller sector indexes, or globally, a handful of stocks is what is driving this global phenomenon that we're seeing global everywhere you look. It's not just here. It is global. And that's something that, you know, just like the financial crisis that we went through in 2007 and 2009, it became a global phenomenon because of the debt that had been accumulated here as well as overseas. Well, the same concentration that you're seeing in a handful of stocks is occurring here and elsewhere around the globe.
So the regulators were saying, this was the talk at the time, they want to make it safer. But through this whole process of the financial crisis and then the investment fads which have followed, which it's actually almost resulted in the opposite of what they were saying, because we have a high concentration now.
Well, it is. And the real question is, what happens when people go to sell? And that's one of the things that we want to delve in terms of this concentration of risk. But we've got to paint the whole picture. It's a concentration in the banking system, a concentration in investment banks. It's a concentration in mutual funds, a concentration in ETFs. It's a concentration in a handful of stocks. So all of this is become highly correlated and concentrated. And John, that is something we have not seen, and we'll get into some of the implications of this.
Now, if we turn to the marketplace, how does all of this play out?
Well, I mean, if you want to take a look at, and this is something John and I talked about in our interview that we did a couple of weeks ago, you want to take a look at what's going to happen to the markets. All right. We've established that the markets are being driven to these higher lofty levels by this small handful of stocks. So as John Rocha was talking about in the interview we did, he goes, he's watching those stocks because it's kind of like the generals. When the generals start to grow over, that tells you that there is a problem coming up.
And I think, although it's hard for me to put these numbers together, it's what I've read perhaps from a research report that came to us, is that 85% of the volume on the New York Stock Exchange is passive related. So if that's the case, it makes sense for me to continue to pay attention to the biggest stocks because they require the lion's share of that volume in a particular ETF. I mean, for example, Apple is in 272 plus ETFs. There's not much difference between one ETF and another if we know that this is the biggest stock and it's in 272 different ETFs. So it behooves me to continue to pay attention to these. And again, I think that these are the drivers of any market move, and we won't know how the market behaves until these stocks deteriorate.
You know, what is really eerie about all of this is that the market rally that began after November 8th has been led by outsized gains that we've seen in the technology sector. And one of the things that John Roach's study did is he took a look and he said, you know, there is some real comparisons to what happened in 1999 and 2000 compared to what's happening today when you take a look at 2016 and 2017 and maybe into 2018 as well. Because if you look back in 1999 to the year 2000, during the internet phase, the tech mania back then, there were four stocks that really made up the bulk of the index. They were Cisco. I can remember Cisco at one time had a market cap of $600 billion. You had Microsoft, Intel, and Oracle, and they made up a little over 15% of the S&P 500 between December 98 and December of 2000. So in a two-year period, these five stocks made up over 15% of the index. Now, fast forward to where we are right now. And right now, you have Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. They make up almost 15% of the index. So a similar move that we saw in technology stocks in 1999 or 98 through 2000, the same thing that we've been seeing through the latter part of actually 2015, going all the way forward to where we are today. And it looks like there's nothing stopping it at this point because the market, what is it? We're doing this show a week early, but the Dow Jones Industrial Average has set 84 records this year. And you can look at those records as being responsible due to mainly five or six stocks within the index. And so that's why John is talking about really following this, because that is your clue to this market where it's really, once again, what are we talking about? The concentration of holdings. As Roke was mentioning, Apple is owned in 272 ETFs. I mean, the ETFs are all looking the same because the large cap weighting within the ETFs are these very same stocks. And so, you know, as I mentioned in the concentration of risk, part one, the top 10 stocks make up the bulk of all three of these indexes. And if you look at the top 10 stocks, they make up the bulk of most major trading indexes around the globe.
Well, I think you actually asked the most important market question extant. And unfortunately, none of us have an answer for it. We do have what I think might have been a preview. So I'll start it by saying like this. We know what ETFs do on the upside. They're monolithic and they are drivers and demanders of participation, and they move stocks and they move indexes. We really don't know what they do on the downside. However, we may have gotten a preview in the summer of 2015 when from July 20th of 2015 through August 24th, or over 25 trading days, the S&P dropped 12.5%. It then had a retest into September 2015. And then we had sort of a reprise of that in December of 2015. From December 2nd through January 20th of 2016, the S&P was down almost 14% over 32 days. We retested in February. So we had two very sharp corrections, 12.5% over 25 days, almost 14% over 32 days. Maybe that was a preview of what we could expect. But I think your question is actually the most important of them all. What can we do if this reverses? And There's no analog to give us some insight as to what happened before.
You know, sometimes we pound on this a lot, Jim, but you know how you have to make some things really clear to people? A lot of people do not understand what it is they own, what they're into, and then especially what the implications for them might be should things go awry.
You know, and you really can. I mean, I'm just going to take one stock. We'll take a couple of them. We'll take the FANG stocks. Apple represents 3.9% of the S&P 500. It represents 5% of the Dow, and it represents 12% of the Qs. So you've got this one stock that is widely held in all these ETFs. It is a major component of all three of the major indexes that we talk here on the show. You know, we talk about the Russell, the small cap, but we're mainly when we're talking about the indexes, when you turn on the nightly news, what are they going to tell you about? They're going to tell you about the S&P and they're going to tell you about the Dow. Occasionally they'll tell you about the NASDAQ. You take a stock like Microsoft, it's 3% of the S&P. And Microsoft is a large portion of the Dow, and it's also a large portion of the Qs. It's, almost 9% of the Qs. You take Amazon, 2% of the S&P. Now, Amazon is not a Dow stock, but in the Qs, it represents almost 1.8%. So these stocks are a portion of all major indexes. They are the most widely held in all these ETFs. And let me give you an example. If you take the top, let's go beyond 10. Let's go to 35. I mean, there's 30 stocks in the Dow. There's 500 in the S&P. There's several thousand in the NASDAQ. There's 100 in the Qs. Apple is owned by 272 ETFs. Google, in both shares, is owned by 204 and 184 ETFs. Microsoft, 246. Facebook, 230. Amazon, 193. Now, the reason I keep driving this point home is when we get to what happens when it comes to selling. So when you have this concentration, when it comes to sell, who do they sell to? And what will it look like when they actually do? I mean, picture five or six guys in a room, and I'm talking about the five largest ETF holders, five largest mutual fund holders who control the bulk of the nation's assets. Now, these five companies all own this concentration of these stocks. So let's say the market starts to roll over. The economy starts to go into a recession as a result of Fed rate hikes, because that's usually the way it ends. Because as the old saying, bull markets don't end. The Fed killed each and every one of them. So the market starts to roll over because the economy is heading into recession. All of a sudden, the smart money starts to sell. They exit their Google trades, their Apple trades, their Facebook or their Amazon trades, where the valuations are, quite honestly, as bad as they were or almost as bad as they were in the tech bubble. So all of a sudden now, the smart money gets out first. They start to liquidate and you start to see distribution in the market. The second thing happens is maybe now the market's down 10, 12, 15%. What usually happens when something like that happens, you get this initial down phase and then you get a corrective rally that comes back because people think, buy the dips. Every time I've done that, it has always worked in the past. So you get a rally that comes back. But it maybe doesn't quite make it to the top again, or maybe you have a double top, and then all of a sudden it starts to fade. This time, instead of being down 10%, it happens quickly. You're down 15 and 20%. All of a sudden now, you're getting investor attention, and you're now getting the attention of media, because that's all they're going to be talking about on the evening news. Next thing you know, the market's down 25 and 30%, and all of a sudden, the individual investor wakes up and says, my $100 holding in my ETF is now worth $70. And that's when the panic sets in. And that's where you see this big selling wave that usually reflects capitulation towards the end or towards a phase, because the bear markets have three phases down as they have bull markets have three phases up. And what's going to make this time interesting is the concentration of holdings. We weren't this concentrated in stocks back in 2007. Well, you could probably say in the year 2000, because the five stocks, Cisco, Intel, those stocks represented about 15% of the S&P, but nowhere near what you're seeing today in all the major indexes, which hold all these stocks and the indexes overseas. The second thing that is making this interesting is algo traders and passive index investing accounts for almost 90% of the volume on the stock exchange, and 85% of daily volume on the exchanges consist of these 10 to 35 stocks. So when you're seeing on the nightly news, the S&P's at a new record, the Dow is at a new record, the Nasdaq is at a new record, look at those stocks, because those are the stocks that are hitting new records that are driving that index higher.
You know, and when you do see these stocks like, Google or Amazon, and they're above $1,000, those have to be institutional buyers, because the average investor doesn't do that. Somebody with the bucks to pony up that much has to be doing that.
Yeah, and that's one thing. And if you take a look at the ownership of these stocks, they are the top 10 owners of each and every one of these stocks are institutions. And that's one thing I noticed when we were doing our first major, what I call one of the major stories of this year, and that was the bubble that we did back in May. I was looking at these stocks, and as I related to you before, I was saying, who's buying these companies at 200 times earnings? Man, this smacks exactly of 1999. And as I looked at each one of these companies and the big drivers behind the indexes, John, it was all major index funds that were the large owners. You know, in the past, you saw Warren Buffett, you might have saw Carl Icahn, a particular equity fund that was the largest owner of this, let's say, a particular stock today. You go right down the board. I don't care if it's Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, all the big, what we call fan stocks, Netflix, they are all index funds. And so that is really something that, and that's why John Roque was talking about, that's why he's following these stocks, because when you're really talking about following the indexes, you're really talking about following the price trading in a handful of selected stocks.
Now, here's a scenario. How does this unfold? I mean, Jim, if you've only got a handful of guys or institutions owning the stocks, right? When they give out sell orders to dump the stocks, they have to be selling to someone that's got to be on the other side of the deal. And then what does the carnage look like when everybody's trying to get out of the burning movie theater together?
You know, you got a glimpse of that in the flash crash that occurred on May 10th in the year 2010. And a good example of that was the Dow stock Procter & Gamble. It opened up at $49.13 a share. And within a 15-minute period, John, the stock drops from 49.13. It dropped all the way down to 31.05 when somebody finally put a bid. So in a matter of 15 minutes, the stock lost 37% of its value. Now, buyers came back in, and eventually the stock closed the day at 48.66. But for a period of time, in a 15-minute period of time, that stock lost almost 40% of its value. And the way the typical stock trades on the exchange, let's just make this easy. Let's say you have a stock that is trading at $100 a share. You may have bids to buy that stock that are lower than its current market price of $100. You may have bids that go all the way down to $90 a share, bids that go all the way down to $80 a share. Normally, they show you on a bid screen, usually 20% below where the stock is trading. The problem is, if let's say you're trading a $100 stock and the last reported bid is at $80, what happens when these computer traders come through and just blow through all the bids in rapid fire? I'm talking nanoseconds, and there's no bids below. So the stock can drop like Procter & Gamble did, almost 40% in 15 minutes, until at some point, somebody somewhere instructs their trade desk, hey, at $36 or $31 a share, I'll buy Procter & Gamble. And finally, you have bids that start to come in to support the stock. So I think that's exactly what you're going to see. You're going to see something very similar, and we don't know what it's going to be. Some kind of event that triggers it. It's a bit of bad news. It's something that captures the market, and it changes the whole paradigm in story scenario. As John Roque says, first, the price action, second, the story. So the first thing that will happen will be the actual action in the stock market and what happens to these stocks. The second will be the reaction to what happens, and that will become the story. And once they have a story, You know what the media does? They run with it 24 hours a day, 5 days, 7 days a week, and then all of a sudden, the whole scenario of what's going on in the marketplace changes to one of greed, to one of fear.
And the new factor in here, especially with the advent of artificial intelligence, I'm not sure how much that is factoring in right now, but Chris Sheridan's done interviews on this before with these algo traders, meaning traders using algorithms, computers making the decisions. First of all, they're making the decisions in milliseconds, Jim, on these things, which questions whether or not you can have any kind of human intervention because it's happening so fast and what the ultimate result of all of this going together remains to be seen.
And that's one of the reasons why I think you have to monitor these stocks. I mean, there are a number of things, and we've done a couple shows of this, of what we're monitoring, because there are a lot of things that are out there right now, and you can't point your finger at just one. But when these stocks begin to top out, the clue will be that this bull market is heading for either one, a serious correction, or a bear market if we are heading into a recession. And so if you take a look at this last quarter, well, there's two what I call pivot points. One was the election, November 8th, of Donald Trump. That started this thing. And then we've had periodic rallies this year. But the strong rally that you're seeing in the market right now is being driven by the tax plan. They're supposed to go to conference, reconcile the differences, come out with a bill that both houses can support, put it up for a bill, and then the president is to sign it on his desk before Christmas. So what is clear, if this goes through, is number one, tax cuts are going to boost corporate profits in 2018. The second thing that stands out, with this kind of stimulus coming into the economy, it's also going to boost GDP growth. We're already tracking over 3% for the first time for three consecutive quarters and for the first time in over 8 years. But there's another agenda in Washington besides the GOP plan to cut taxes. There's the Federal Reserve, and you as an investor should be following the actions of both the tax plan and also what the Fed is going to do. As I've stated, they are going to continue raising interest rates next year. They raised them a quarter of a point for the third time on the 13th. They also stated that next year, they're going to continue to contract their balance sheet. So we've gone from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening. They are also going to continue to raise their interest rates. So what is the Fed looking at from their point of view? They're looking at the lowest unemployment rate in 17 years. Number two, they're looking at wages that are starting to rise above 3%. To them, they look at that as an inflationary, not the fact that you're keeping even with inflation. Inflation, whether it's producer prices or consumer prices, are starting to pick up. Oil prices are in the upper 50s, and GDP growth is starting to accelerate. All of which means that the Fed will continue to raise. Right now, they're planning 3, maybe possibly 4 rate hikes next year. In this economy, which is leveraged at record levels at the government level, the corporate level, and the consumer level, cannot withstand the interest rates that we were used to 5, 10 years ago. So how long before we have this clash between monetary and fiscal policy? Because right now, the odds are for almost a 90% increase in another Fed funds rate hike coming in January. So just like we did in 2017, we will have 2 back-to-back rate hikes. If the Fed raises in January, that'll put the Fed funds rate at 1.75%. You could see the 2-year note over 2%. So we're either going to see, as a result of quantitative tightening, you're going to start to see the 10-year note start to rise, or worse, you could see a flattening or inversion of the yield curve, which is one of the primary indicators for looking at a possible recession.
So here you have two policies, obviously at odds with each other. And I know you're watching credit spreads and large cap stocks. Now, when they roll over, what do you do?
When they start to roll over, there's a couple things you can do. Either one, if you are in these stocks, have trailing stops so you don't have this happen to you and you lose your profits. Number two, when they start rolling over, and especially if they're combined with indicators that show that the economy is heading for a major slowdown or a possible recession, that's the time you're going to want to short. And it's also the time you're going to want to put protective hedges like puts on your portfolio. Because one of the things we know about markets is this will someday come to an end. They always do. this will not continue. And most importantly, remember this, and this is probably the hardest thing that most people, you know, you're really not thinking about it. Recessions and bear markets begin during the good times, not during the bad times. It was why back in 2009, 10, 11, and 12, we were telling you, buy stocks. It's a place to be, because the bad times, which were what we went through in 2007 and 2009, that already happened. The crash, the S&P lost 58% of its value, and that's why we were so positive in our orientation on the market. But John, this too will come to an end, and I predict that next year, as we get into our forecast issue, will be a year of greater volatility. There's just no way that you can be this far into a Fed rate raising cycle with this amount of leverage and this amount of concentration for something not to end badly.
That's the last live program of the year. Now, if anything important happens, we'll come back and do another special show to keep you abreast of what's going on there. But this is traditionally our vacation time. Anything else I didn't think of, Jim?
No, that's pretty much it. I mean, all eyes are going to be on this tax bill. So we're going to be watching that to see how it plays out. Of course, that is going to be much of what we talk about next year. The two stories we'll be spending on 2018 will be the impact of the tax bill, assuming it does get passed, and the possible conflicts between monetary and fiscal policy. And one other one I'd throw in there is China are going to be some of the big stories for 2018. In the meantime, well, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to wish you a happy holiday and Christmas season. Happy Hanukkah. And John, are we forgetting anything else? Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, Christmas.
New Year's.
New Year. Yeah. Okay, New Year's.
Okay.
And a Happy New Year. And a prosperous 2018 to all of you. We'd like to thank you, all of you, for joining us here on the program. We've had some great guests and some great shows. Hope you have enjoyed the programs, and we'll be making some new improvements coming into the new year. In the meantime, safe holidays and a happy one with you and your loved ones.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.